You're listening to Doing It Right with me, Pandora Sykes, a podcast where I talk to experts about the myths, anxieties, and trends of modern life. In this series, Series 4, I'll be exploring topics including postpartum psychosis, sociopathy, and how technology has flattened personal taste. This is a podcast that asks, what can we do to understand life better? Not just for ourselves, but for everyone. For the first time ever, I'm dropping the whole series in one as a capsule box set. So tuck in and don't forget to let me know your thoughts at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Catherine Cho is a literary agent and the author of the 2020 book Inferno, a memoir of motherhood and madness, about the postpartum psychosis she experienced after the birth of her son, Cato. So many women experience what is categorised as a postpartum mental disorder after having a baby. For me, it was postnatal depression. For Catherine, it was postpartum psychosis. You might not have thought about postpartum psychosis ever before. You might not have ever heard of it, but it's much more common than I realised before I read Inferno. One in two women in 1,000 will be affected by it. So why isn't it being talked about more? In this episode, Catherine describes her stint on an involuntary psychiatric ward as a complete lack of reality, where she lost all sense of time and space. We also discuss how it came to happen, how it impacted her family, the depression which followed her psychosis, and how she navigated second-time motherhood, where she had a 50% risk of developing postpartum psychosis again. I'm pleased to say she was very well the second time round. I understand that this episode might feel too daunting for some people, but I'm a big believer in forewarned is forearmed, that knowing about these things can better protect us and also those around us. Putting aside the individual, I think that socially, culturally, and politically, we should be talking more about matrescence, which is thought to be as seismic a cognitive change as puberty, and maternal mental health. I'm so grateful to Catherine for speaking so honestly about her experience. If you find this episode helpful, please do share it with others in need. You can also find resources in the show notes. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on to Doing It Right.
Thank you for having me.
Your son was 8 days short of his 100-day birthday, a big celebration in Korean culture, when you began to see devils in his eyes. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to end up on an involuntary psychiatric ward suffering with postpartum psychosis?
Yes, so this was in 2018. It was my first time, I was a first-time mother. We had decided to use our parental leave to go to the States, which in retrospect was not a great idea. But we left when my son was 2 months old, and we did a cross-country trip from California to Virginia and New Jersey. And it very much went against all the things that we had been told. My parents and my in-laws are Korean, and the idea in Korean culture is to stay inside. And they thought what we were doing was very risky. And I believe it was a combination of lack of sleep, of travel, and just continually hearing these warnings, which led to me developing postpartum psychosis, which was a complete lack of reality. And I lost all sense of time and space.
What struck you and the reader about postpartum psychosis is that it happens so quickly. You know, when you left for your trip, you were exhausted. And even at the beginning of your trip, you were exhausted, but you were mentally well. How did it happen so quickly? Do you think it's truly just the effect of if you do not sleep for more than one or two nights, things unravel very quickly?
You know, I've thought a lot about this just because I think the psychiatrist said that my psychosis, postpartum psychosis, was stress-induced. Which is unusual. Often postpartum psychosis happens the first couple of days of birth, so it was actually unusual that it happened so late, relatively speaking. I think it was not just 1 or 2 days of sleep, but if I look back on it, I think it's such a prolonged, kind of slow The lack of sleep for sure. But I think it's, you know, so many other factors as well in terms of just the stresses, emotional. I was definitely ignoring kind of my own mental well-being. And I was genuinely, I think I was really worried about what I was doing and the lack of certainty of and confidence of being a first-time mother, which I think led to it being so extreme. And I also think when I look back on it now, there were probably signs that I should have been paying attention to, you know, kind of my lack of awareness about things, but it definitely felt very dramatic in that it did feel like I slipped into insanity in a period of a day or two.
I didn't realize till I read your book that postpartum psychosis affects 1 or 2 in 1,000 women. And as you've mentioned, typically it happens quite soon after birth. Is it just me or is that quite a high statistic?
It's funny because everyone was like, it's so rare. It's only 1 or 2 in 1,000. And to me, that sounds really high.
Me too.
Yeah, I think I don't know about the statistics, but yeah, it does. And I think especially because it's something that, you know, I hadn't heard about before until I'd actually experienced it. And I think, and especially as well as that it happens to women without any history of mental illness and that it really could happen due to a variety of factors. I think it is pretty high.
So you mentioned just then that it often happens to women who have had no history of mental illness. But in the book, you explore your life up until that point, your upbringing and a traumatic past relationship, which you essentially ran away from in the dead of night, like a really traumatic experience. Do you think there was a kind of history of vulnerability which you had not necessarily explored that may have also engendered these feelings around that? I could be reaching here, so please tell me if I am.
No, definitely. I mean, I think part of the reason why I wrote the book and structured it the way it did and that the psychosis itself happens, I think, around the 2/3 mark is I wanted to kind of show all the things that make up a person. And I think we all have these histories. We all hold, you know, the body keeps the score, as you say. You keep these things that you know from childhood, from relationships. And I think, you know, the relationship I had was a very violent one. It was in my early 20s. And I personally thought that I'd kind of set it aside. But what revealed, I think, was in that vulnerable point, all the things that I'd tried to forget about definitely came. And it was a culmination of all the experiences that I'd had up to that point.
I think what also really struck me is that a lot of the things that characterize postpartum psychosis are things that characterize early motherhood generally. Exhaustion, disassociation, paranoia, anxiety, a fractured identity. And is it that line is actually incredibly fragile between sanity and insanity in those early months?
I think so. I mean, I think what I hadn't realized in early motherhood is, well, first, you do lose a sense of self, that dissociation. And I think in other cultures, there are actually words for it. There's an expectation that in becoming a mother, while you do gain something, you also lose something. And it's just such a sudden shift. It happens instantaneously from the moment you give birth. Suddenly, I think the doctors even refer to you as mom and, you know, the patient is the baby. And it's something that I think your mind has to kind of catch up to. It's not immediate. And I think definitely with postpartum psychosis, it's kind of an extreme version of that. The loss of time. I was already losing my sense of time in those first few months because it's not daytime, nighttime. It's, you know, these kind of repeating moments of feeding, sleeping, you know, changing. And I think psychosis, yeah, it really kind of just, it was an extreme expression of that.
And there's also that really sort of awful thing, and it's no individual's fault in the hospital, but my friends and I always refer to the labor ward as the kind of fifth circle of hell because you cannot sleep. You come out of hospital. If you're in for, you know, 4 days, then you don't sleep for 4 days because, I mean, the speakerphone has been the bane of all of my births. Why do people speak on speakerphones? I do not understand.
Yeah, you're on this ward with so many women. There's like plastic curtains. You've gone through a physical trauma, you know, no matter what kind of birth you have. And Yeah, as you say, you don't sleep. And I remember there was somebody who was playing like a radio, and I'd had a C-section, so I couldn't like stand up easily to go talk to them. And like, I just was like, what is happening? And you lose all sense of, you know, as you, like, what is daytime? Because it never feels dark either. So yeah, it's definitely a circle of hell.
And there's that complete loss of dignity. I can remember, because if you have an epidural, you obviously lose kind of the function of the lower end of your body. And there was a poor woman on the ward that I was on who could not stop farting. And it was so loud. And I felt so sorry for her. But anyway, this is all to say that it does not set you up well in terms of resilience. And I think that is one of the greatest ironies, is that you are in both the best place when you just had a baby because you're surrounded by medical experts, but the worst place because you can't sleep, which is, as we've discussed, the absolute key to sanity. I experienced postpartum depression, nothing like the depth of trauma you experience. I want to make that really clear. But for me, that brief period of time was characterized by paranoia. I was convinced people were watching me. I was hyperactive and unable to eat and sleep. So a lot of, I suppose, quite similar symptoms. And what struck me reading the book that I felt so awful for you is that sense of surveillance, in your case, actually really was kind of factual, because everywhere you were staying in America, people had those Nest home cameras, which I also think are really kind of terrifying part of modern life. Do you think it was really compounded by, you know, I could say, oh, I think people are watching me. Okay, but I know nobody's watching me, like, intellectually. Whereas you felt like people were watching you, and there were cameras on you.
There were. Yeah, it's such a strange thing, because I, as an American, I don't know if it's like a cultural thing, but that sense of kind of like home protection. So yeah, everywhere we went, there were Nest cams, and they were recording, and you could hear audio and video. And yeah, so I thought I was being watched, and genuinely I was. And yeah, it's such a surreal experience, because you also, there was a point where I think everybody assumed that I knew that the cameras were there, but actually it was, I think, several days in before I realized like every room has a camera. And it just, you know, I had been walking around like with my top off because I'd been breastfeeding, and like that will obviously felt really invasive, but also just like I became really aware of the things that I was saying, and it definitely increased my level of paranoia. It's something funny in retrospect, because my in-laws still don't really understand why I found that so disturbing, because that's just something that's so normal to them in terms of having the Nest cams on. So yeah,
I think that is a cultural thing, because I would find that really terrifying as well. I don't think I'd actually be able to stay in a house with it. And I'm also thinking that, just in terms of, the only time I've seen that in a British home is when I was watching like a deep fake thriller on Netflix the other day. You know, like it was like planted kind of home filming. So yeah, I definitely don't feel like that's something we're that used to in the UK. But to go back to when it immediately happened, it all obviously unraveled very quickly, and you were in your in-laws' home, and there was a real feeling of anxiety, because as you say, they were very, very worried that you had come on this trip, that you weren't respecting various traditions. And you said to your husband, we need to leave. And he, you know, was great. He said, right, we'll go straight away. But as soon as you were in a hotel, he could tell that you were very unwell. And as soon as you got to hospital, you were there for 4 days, and then you went into the involuntary psychiatric unit, and you were away for 12 days total. But reading the book, and I'm sure for you at the time, it feels like a lifetime. When you look back at that experience now, does time feel elastic? Does it feel short, or does it feel like a lifetime?
It feels like lifetimes. I remember when I was working on the book, somebody was like, could you demarcate the times or the days spent? And I really couldn't, because there are days that I spent on the ward where I know this because my husband told me that he came to visit me, but I genuinely have no recollection of that. And in the hospital, when I was really in the depths of psychosis and the medications weren't working, I was experiencing every moment in multiple. So not just what was actually happening, but like kind of false memories, like books and stories. And so it's even now very hard for me to trace what is an actual moment and what was my kind of subconscious or imagination. So those 4 days in the hospital, they felt like very much like years, just mentally speaking.
And when you're on the psychiatric ward again, that element of surveillance is so painful, because you felt like you were being watched you were being watched, you were being monitored 24/7. And that would be quite difficult when you would speak to your husband and he would say, oh, I hear you're doing better or something like that. And you would say, well, how do you know? And then you'd think, oh my God, they're watching me. How did you disentangle the healthy surveillance and the paranoid feeling of surveillance? Like, that must be really difficult.
It is. And it's funny because I had the sense that other patients were watching me as well. And I thought they were talking about me. And I've talked about this with my husband later. And he's like, I think that's just your paranoia. That was your paranoia. But it is really hard to entangle those because I'm pretty sure they were. we were all talking about each other. Everybody was paranoid at the time. You know, we're all experiencing our own kind of mental crisis. And I think the doctors, I understand because they were so overwhelmed and so they couldn't communicate with patients and they didn't want to start a dialogue. But there is something completely infuriating and also maddening about knowing that somebody's watching you but not engaging with you. It does make you feel like you're insane, even if you are, because you're a patient. But it's that balance of...
Well, it's quite dehumanizing as well,
isn't it? It's very dehumanizing, yes. And knowing that I had to behave in a certain way to seem, you know, well enough to leave, but also not really being treated like an individual or being spoken with, I think was a really difficult thing.
That awful sense of you trying to act sane and trying to act like you don't want to get out too much, like all of those extreme emotions like panic or desperation have to be kind of quashed. So you can't seem desperate to get out. Right. You can't seem panicked about getting out. But it reminded me in an awful way of Jessamine Chan's book, The School for Good Mothers. Have you read that book?
Yes, yes. What a frightening story.
I mean, obviously a very different, that's a dystopian novel, but there's a moment where Lydia can't be seen to be too keen to get her daughter or seen as inappropriate. And it made me wonder, reading your book, did you feel like there was a game you had to play throughout all of this to prove something?
Definitely. I think because I became aware that I was involuntary, like nobody spelled that out for me. I figured that out, that it was up to somebody else to decide when I was to leave. I was also aware that anytime my husband came and we met with the social workers, they took what he said seriously because he kept saying that he didn't think I was well. And I was so frustrated that he didn't realize, well, I think he did realize, but he genuinely thought I wasn't well, but I felt well. And I was like, I'm going to have to convince them that I'm well. So I can't seem, you know, like in Jessamine Chan's novel, I can't seem too desperate to leave, even though I think anyone would know I would be desperate to leave. And I remembered that I tried to see myself in the way that they were seeing myself, which in retrospect is a bit maybe dangerous because that's like a play on psychosis where you're perceiving things the way other people perceive. But I felt like I was playing this part of, you know, I'm the patient and I understand that I'm unwell and I feel much better, you know. And they eventually took my word over his and they did release me early, I suppose, because I did a convincing job of seeming well.
It's horribly meta. You were playing a sort of part within what you thought was a play and what was a part. You wrote a lot about how the psychiatric ward was divided along racial lines and the ways to identify each other was often by race. At the time, or looking back, were you surprised by that?
I think I was surprised just because I'd spent so much time in the UK where I do feel like it's not so racially divided or fraught. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but in the States, it is such a clear way. And I understand why the ward was like that. It's just because you can barely see people's faces, you know, and so what you immediately notice is just what they look like. And it did remind me of the Netflix show, which Orange is the New Black. And I felt immediately so privileged that the only way I could really relate to this was through a TV show. But that's how I felt because, and also, to be frank, I think there was one other Asian person who came later, but there were very few of us. And so I immediately stood out as somebody who didn't belong there. And so I didn't have an obvious group to fit into.
Another thing you mentioned, which you've just mentioned the word privilege there, is you said that you were aware even as you were very unwell, or not necessarily when you were very unwell, but when you were still relatively unwell, you were aware of your privilege being there. You said, you know, outside of this hospital, I have a home and I wear branded name leggings. A lot of the people there didn't have someone rooting for them, didn't have someone working with them to get them out, did they?
No, and I think that's what's really devastating, especially when I look back, is they didn't have visitors and they didn't have people calling them. And
that's so crucial, right, to you getting better.
Yeah, to getting better, but also to have somebody to advocate for you. So I had my husband who made sure that, you know, I had my glasses. Like, they didn't realize that I had glasses. And so, you know, I'm very nearsighted, but he made sure I had glasses. He made sure that I had a notebook. Apparently he said I was walking around with like my hands around my eyes and pretending they were glasses, and the nurses just mentioned it to him. He was like, oh my gosh, she needs her glasses. And
that
kind of thing, if you're a patient and you don't have that, like, how devastating is that? And I remember speaking to some of them where they knew that their family had, if they had family, that they didn't want to deal with it. And I think that kind of awareness was also really difficult, in that they didn't have somebody waiting for them to come out. They didn't have somebody to cover, you know, their Uber to go somewhere. They didn't have anywhere to go. And yeah, there was one patient who wanted to stay because he was homeless and he didn't have a place to leave. And ironically, that made the process of him being moved go faster. But yeah, it was really difficult to see that.
Oh my God, there's sort of an awful irony there, isn't it? As if you want to stay,
yes,
you tend to be ready to leave. And if you want to leave, you tend to not be quite ready for you to go. The psychosis itself was relatively short compared to the recovery. When you got back to the UK, you experienced a deep depression, which lasted 2 months. You were barely able to get out of bed. Can you talk a little bit about that change in state and why this often happens after the mania of psychosis?
Yeah, so I was released, and then I think 2 days later, we flew back to the UK on the original flight we had planned. And I was immediately referred to a perinatal psychiatrist who, and at the time, even though I probably should have realized I wasn't well, I thought the story was over. But I was like, okay, you know, this happened. I was thinking about how to go back to work. And she said, like, often in cases like these, you will experience depression. And I really didn't understand. And then I think it was almost like somebody just turned the lights out. I really just physically, mentally couldn't function. And my understanding of this is it could be because of the medication. It could be a response to the brain just having been in the manic state. The medication that I was on was haloperidol, which is a first generation drug, which is known for being incredibly kind of harsh on the system. And actually, one of the things my husband tried to do was to try to move me off that drug as quickly as possible. But that depression, those 2 months, in many ways, that was the hardest part of the experience, I think, just because it felt very hopeless.
You wouldn't have been put on that drug if you'd been in the UK, would you?
No. At least that's my understanding. There are so many other drugs that they would try first. And I think for whatever reason, and I don't, to be fair, I haven't fully looked into it, that's not a drug that they would resort to so quickly, at least.
I was really struck when I was rereading Inferno, is there's obviously a lot in the papers at the moment about how maternal units on the NHS are failing, or things that have gone wrong, which is often placed on individual midwives and is almost always because of structural strains and inefficiencies and lack of protection for the actual midwives and all of that. But something that struck me to the positive of the NHS, but also really enraged me reading about your experience, is that had this happened in the UK, you would have never been separated from your baby, Kato. The most important thing during episodes like this in the UK is that mother and baby are kept together. Mm-hmm. My sister's a midwife who works in mental health and safeguarding, and so I know from her that on psychiatric units, they are adamant that mother and baby are kept together because that dislocation at such a young age is just so incredibly traumatic for both of you. Why does this not happen in the States, do you know?
I don't know. And it's something that I've tried to understand. Just, I said to someone, you can write a full book about how different it is in the States. And I think, you know, it doesn't, first of all, yes, mother-baby units, that seems so obvious. Like, why would you put somebody who's going through postpartum psychosis into a general facility, you know, separating them from the baby? That just seems, you know, very illogical.
especially if you've already seen Devils in Your Baby's Eyes, like the chances are you're struggling with that identity shift. So to take away the baby.
Yeah, it's very, and I think, you know, the other element, you know, I didn't have health insurance in the US. I had travel insurance, which is partly why.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know. Every time I say that, people, yeah, but it really was that thing where they weren't sure that I'd be able to pay the bills. And so I was put into a facility, which was like a Medicare, Medicaid facility, which is why so many of the patients on the ward were, you know, veterans or homeless, which is, you know, that's a whole other conversation to have about that, but incredibly frightening. And then also when I was released in the US, I was just released. They gave me a prescription for more haloperidol and there was no follow-up, nothing else. Like, it was terrifying. Whereas I feel like with NHS, it's very much this idea of, you know, I met with a team for the perinatal psychosis, but also a team that was for people who had experienced psychosis before the age of 35. And they followed me for 3 years in the sense that if I needed help, I could reach out to them. And like that kind of thing, that kind of network, I think is just so logical and would really help prevent this kind of revolving door, because in the States, a lot of the patients, they would leave just to come straight back because there was no care, you know, there was no idea of safeguarding. And so, yeah, there are so many things that I don't really understand about the US medical system, but there just seems to be so many more cracks that people can fall through.
Hearing you say that makes me really proud of the NHS, and it makes me feel, obviously, it's very timely to bash the NHS and talk about all the ways in which it's failing. But hearing you say that, like, what an incredible thing. And when you compare it to the care in the States, I mean, it's incomparable.
It really is incomparable. Like, I say that to so many people. I just, yeah. And having experienced both sides, I really feel I can say that firsthand. So, yeah.
Along with obviously not being with Cato, which has absolutely ramifications for how you bond with him again when you come out, something that's also very difficult to read is how you were forced to give up breastfeeding cold turkey, but with no one really explaining that that's what was happening. And you were obviously in such a mental state at the time that a nurse would have to sort of tell you to massage your breasts, which were incredibly painful and engorged. I mean, dropping breastfeeding cold turkey is stressful enough even with a sane mind. So for anyone listening who doesn't know, experts advise dropping one feed every kind of 3 to 5 days, very slowly, because the drop in hormones can be extremely upsetting. That is without postpartum psychosis and without necessarily even remembering that you were breastfeeding before you came in. I wondered, how did you metabolize that whole experience afterwards? Because you had been breastfeeding before. It was something that you were passionate about. Do you grieve that? How have you kind of processed that?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I was, you know, breastfeeding with Cato was like such a journey in the sense that I was really like determined to do it. And, you know, I had mastitis, I had overproduction issues, like all of the things. And so, yes, dropping cold turkey was one of the things that, you know, mastitis was very much, I think, on my husband's mind, for example, that I would have an infection. And it's not that I grieve it. I think I just felt a deep sense of, I suppose, loss. And then also, I've had a second child, my daughter, who I did breastfeed until she was a year. And I remember somebody kind of carelessly said to me, like, oh, you know, like, how great that you're able to do that for her, but too bad for your son. And I was like,
that's very helpful.
I know. And then I felt really angry at myself for feeling guilty, because I was like, genuinely, I had no control over that. Like, why do I feel guilty about that? I mean, as with so many things about motherhood, but yeah, it's a very complicated emotion for sure.
I want to get to your second experience of motherhood, because I'm sure that that might have been a little bit daunting. But I wondered what you thought about, we're in what feels like a bit of a cultural impasse at the moment with being honest about motherhood and maternal mental health and this whole thing about not scaring people off. And that was something I personally was always quite scared about. And this episode, for instance, will be hard for some people to listen to. And yet I also feel, when mental health and motherhood is concerned, that forewarned is forearmed. Certainly there were things that I didn't know that in hindsight I wish I had known around mental health. And I'm quite angry now that NCT classes don't ever cover mental health, that I had, you know, 3 hours on what nuts I should be eating when I was pregnant, but nothing about what might happen to my brain. And the statistics, as we have discussed, are relatively high that you may encounter some kind of mental health condition. I'm trying to think of the right word. I think we have to have this knowledge in order to better protect ourselves and to know when to ask for help. Where do you stand on this? And I don't know if this is the right word, this debate of sorts.
I find it really interesting. I mean, I'm also the type of person where I think being forewarned is forearmed. Like, I know when I, before I gave birth, like, I was reading all the kind of birth stories. Like, I wanted to know everything, but that's, you know, I suppose my personality. But I also find it slightly infantilizing to say, let's not talk about this because it might scare people, because then that means we're being dishonest. Like, I'm not, you know, the part of the reason in sharing about postpartum psychosis isn't to, like, wave a black flag to be like, this could happen to you, a sense of doom, but more like, this could happen. And if it happens, like, this is what you do. And this is what it means. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're a bad mother, for example, or that you should feel ashamed about it. And that to me is the thing that's most important, more so than, and I don't want anyone to feel warned off or scared about being a mother. Like, that's never my intention. But I think these are conversations that we should be having and to be transparent. And of course, maybe the negative conversations are louder than the positives, but I feel like there are so many positives about motherhood that we do talk about and celebrate and have celebrated for such a long time. So
you're really honest in the book, and I would say this is a major tension in the book, about how different generations have different capacities for discussing mental health. And I think what we hear a lot now, and I think there are limits to this, it's something that can make me feel quite frustrated sometimes, is we'll talk to your family. But a lot of people's family literally cannot have that conversation. And a lot of people are really, really bad about talking about emotional or mental stuff. And actually, to give them that precious knowledge about yourself when you're feeling fragile could be a really damaging thing to do. It could actually make you feel worse. How do you think your when you were away, you were with family, and the feelings of your family were very much something you intimately had to absorb. I wondered how that impacted you and how you have since navigated those limitations, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, I fully understand, I empathize and understand my parents and my in-laws' generation, because they came from post-war Korea. You know, in a way, they didn't have the time to think about their mental well-being. They were just so busy trying to survive. And I do think, because also, and there's a cultural element to it, not just a generational one, I think so much this idea, like, keeping, you know, the stiff upper lip, saving face, not admitting to feeling uncertain, some, like, your inner thoughts were something that you're supposed to keep really to yourself. And so I don't think they'd ever encountered anybody who'd gone through mental illness, and so they found that I think they still find it difficult, like, why are you talking about this when it's something you should keep inside? And I think my mom very honestly said to me that she always thought depression was just somebody needed to, like, pick themselves up and get on with it kind of thing. And she said, I learned that actually you really couldn't, like, I just couldn't. And I think they've gained a new understanding about what mental health means. But yeah, the conversations are difficult. And I think I have a lot of empathy because I understand that they're working with a limited vocabulary. You know, these kind of, the things that we talk about now are things that were never discussed back then. And also, I guess, just to say, with the book, from their perspective, their rather sensitive daughter-in-law came to their house and went insane. And, you know, and I think in many ways they still feel that way. And so it's obviously very difficult to hear my perspective, which is, because of your anxieties and all the things that you were saying as medical professionals and, like, with Korean traditions, caused me to feel this way. And that cause and effect is, you know, it's a difficult one. And I personally, you know, I have not take responsibility, that's the wrong way to phrase it, but I am aware that postpartum psychosis, no matter the environment I was in, it was me, right? And so I try not to place blame. And I think also I try not to feel a sense of injustice or grief. It was an experience that happened, and for whatever reason it happened, and we've kind of had to grow from it and learn from it.
Yeah, so for context, your father-in-law is a pediatrician, and he was actually the one that took you aside and said, I think you might be suffering from postpartum depression. And he also said to you, didn't he, like, these are our anxieties, and I am I am sorry that you have absorbed them. So there was that awareness there, wasn't it? Is it something you still talk about, or have you, for kind of relationship's sake, parked the experience, as you say, and grown from it?
I mean, we still talk about it. It's a difficult thing to talk about, obviously. I think they were very surprised and I think hurt by the perspective that I had. And also because I think it's not something we can ever really talk directly about, but, you know, we've kind of alluded to. And we still, you know, talk about kind of, even now, kind of medical anxieties. But what I've learned from it is, yes, not to take on their anxieties as my own, which at the time I couldn't do.
That's still hard. I mean, one of the hardest things I think about parenting is the comments from your own parents and respecting their opinion, saying thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, and then doing what you want anyway. Like, it's a really hard thing to navigate without the experience you've had.
No, definitely. Yes. So, and I'm still learning. It's a continual learning process. So, yes. But I'm very grateful to them for, they understand. And, you know, they're also very forgiving. And I think there's been a lot of forgiveness on both sides. So it's overall, it's, you know, we have a very strong relationship. So, yeah.
That's such a wonderfully generous act on both of your parts. It's really galvanizing to hear. You mentioned that you've since had another baby, a little girl, and the risk for postpartum psychosis when you've experienced it once is really high, 50% for a subsequent child.
Yes.
That is really daunting. How did you feel approaching that? Was there a time when you or your husband thought, can we do this again? How did you prepare for that?
Yeah, so I think that was one of the first conversations we had when I was kind of well with a perinatal psychiatrist, which she said, I just have to let you know that, you know, the odds go up, it's 50%. And immediately my husband just said, okay, well, thank you, great. We will not have another child. And I was like, okay. And it's not a decision that I took lightly at all, just because I know how much, not just I went through, but like the people around me went through. But
of course.
I think maybe it's just because I had written about it, but I thought so much about it. I really felt like I could trace and understand the things that had happened and why. Maybe if I didn't have that confidence, I wouldn't have had another baby. I'd always in my head, you know, would have hoped for two children. And, you know, it took time, and I was actually the one, I think I was ready first. And my husband was, I think, initially, you know, afraid. And I understand that. And actually, I think a few weeks after I found out I was pregnant, we went into lockdown and I just saw my husband's kind of panic, where he was like, oh no, like, what does that mean?
Did that help in any way? Because definitely the context around you getting sick was a lot of other people's opinions and encountering a lot of other people.
Ironically, yes.
And I wondered if like bedding down and just being your immediate unit like might have helped at all. I don't mean to reduce what people went through in that, by the way.
Yeah, no, definitely. And yeah, same. But in a way, yes, in a way it was like I did the 21 days of confinement, you know, which because nobody could come.
So you inadvertently respected the traditions that you'd ignored the first time around.
Exactly. Inadvertently had to stay home, which I was like, oh, and like you are kind of in this cocoon, you know, so.
Did you have the seaweed soup this time, though?
I mean, I had to. Yes, I did. I did shower, though. I was like, I have to shower. I can't not shower. But I did have a lot of seaweed soup.
How did you gain trust in yourself after your illness? I mean, one of the things we haven't really spoken about, and I think it's probably because he is so absent from the book, and that is, of course, like part of your recovery and part of your husband's fear, is your relationship with Cato. When you were sick, you know, you would say, I am ready to come home. And he would say, well, you're not. And you would say, why don't you think I am? Mm-hmm. And he would say, well, you still haven't asked about the baby. How did you learn to trust yourself again? Trust your relationship with him? Was it just a case of giving it time?
Time and, to be honest, a lot of effort. I think one of the things that's the most devastating thing about postpartum psychosis is I physically couldn't touch Cato. Like, it caused a lot of pain. And I physically felt this barrier, which is, you know, really difficult and surprising. But I've thought a lot about it since, and I think I say this in the book too. I think it's a protection mechanism. I think it's the body recognizes that as a mother, you can't be trusted. And that's kind of devastating. Mm. But because of that, in a protection mechanism, I physically couldn't touch him. And part of the exercise every day was the psychiatrist asked that I try to hold Cato for 5 minutes. And so I'd hold him for 5 minutes. And it just felt so difficult to do that, however basic that was, considering he was always on me before. But those 12 days meant that it really hurt to touch him. And then it just took more and more time. And I had to make a distinct effort and energy. Like, I have notebooks where I've just written, you must try and build your relationship, because it wasn't just going to automatically come back, as much as I would have loved for that too. It was something I had to build. And I had to trust also, to be completely transparent, I wasn't left alone with him for a very long time. I think my husband never directly said so, but he just wasn't 100% sure.
Who would be with you when your husband couldn't be with you?
So his university actually helped pay for a babysitter, a lovely woman named Jane, who stayed with me, the both of us, until I think Cato was 8 months old. And then he went to nursery. And then when he was in nursery, my husband would pick him up and we would always be together. But yeah, and even sleeping, I would sleep in the bedroom and my husband would sleep in the hallway and Cato would be in the living room, just because I think he was a bit nervous that I'd be sleepwalking or something. You know, it just, that kind of trust had broken.
Did you notice that at the time? Did you ever say to him, I know what you're doing?
Actually, I really didn't. I didn't notice it. It wasn't until I had really recovered a lot where he told me more specifically. I knew he didn't fully trust me, and that was really frustrating to me, not because of like Cato's safety, but more just I felt well. But yes, I think it was many months later where he specifically said, like, you were like talking in your sleep and I thought you might be sleepwalking. And yeah, that then I realized kind of the extent to the worry. And again, that also made me really think about how much he had to go through and how serious it was.
It must have been incredibly traumatizing for him.
Oh, yes, for him.
How did he and you as a partnership rebuild from that?
It was really traumatizing for him. I think the one thing that I'll say about him that really, it never changed the way he saw me, which I think is such an incredible thing.
That's really lovely. Yeah, really, that's a real testament to him.
Because I think it's really, you know, and I don't know that I'd be strong enough to feel that way. He knew I was unwell. And I think fundamentally because of that, he was able to kind of stay with me and to take care of me. But it would have broken me if he thought, oh, she's not a good mother. You know, like if he ever said anything like that or suggested that, it would have broken me. And I think that kind of support is so important in recovery from.
It's a very delicate dance he had to do, isn't it?
Yeah, when a delicate of, yes, I trust you, but also I don't really.
Yes, exactly. You've got this, but yeah. Yeah, completely.
But, you know, one thing I think we've always been good at, but it has really helped with this, is like communication. Like, I've always felt that I could tell him if I wasn't feeling well. And he always would ask me. And I think, funny enough, kind of once I got better, then he became kind of, went through like, I think a slight form of PTSD. They called it chronic stress, but the, you know, a really high cortisol level for a prolonged period of time isn't great for your brain either. Mm-hmm. so yeah, and then I kind of took on like the load of things, and we took turns. But yeah, I think I really learned that I could rely on him, which was a gift.
Was your experience as a family with your daughter very different then?
Yes, it was night and day. I mean, so I had a planned cesarean with my daughter. We talked a lot about it with my psychiatrist and everything. And they just said, like, let's try to keep all the factors as calm as possible.
As controlled as possible.
Yeah. As controlled, exactly. They talked about putting me on medication beforehand. But I think because it was stress-induced, I had a prescription ready just in case. But I wasn't on any medication. And I know that some women go on medication before. And actually, even though it was during lockdown, because I'd had postpartum psychosis, we were given a separate room. So I bypassed the whole labor ward. And I was like, wow, perks of psychosis.
silver linings.
Silver linings. And my husband was allowed to stay the night. And they actually told him, like, please don't come out of the ward because there are no other partners on the floor right now. Because they all had to go home. Yeah, exactly. They'll be like, why is he here?
I'm so glad to hear that, actually, because I wouldn't have thought that was a given, as in I've heard so many horror stories during COVID. And obviously you can't blame any of the, you can't blame the hospitals for the decisions they made, because it was just like the most awful time for hospitals. But I'm so pleased to hear that you had a positive experience, because I think there are so many really negative experiences of that time for women.
Yes. No, I felt very lucky. And I think they were, because I think also, I'm not even sure how it would have, like, if, God forbid, anything had happened, like, with the mother-baby units. Like, yeah, I think about all the things that happened during the pandemic with women going through psychosis or anything postnatal, and it is really devastating to think about. Yeah, no, I felt very taken care of, and I was immediately, because of my history, referred to the team, and actually it was the same perinatal psychiatrist, Dr. Taha, who had taken care of me the first time, who was helping me this time, so she knew kind of everything that I'd gone through. And yeah, I don't know why, if my daughter, if I just had the confidence, but breastfeeding was like immediate with my daughter. She didn't have, like with Kato, I had to stay in the hospital for a week because I'd had sepsis and he was on antibiotics, but you know, we were able to go home quickly. And yeah, we were in our little cocoon, and it just felt very easy the second time around. So that was a relief.
It just sounds like it was different in every single way from the very beginning. And as you say as well, having that continuity of care is, I think, gold dust. Mm-hmm. Someone that knew your experience before, because something I often hear with trauma is that having to repeat your story, having to tell it from scratch to all these different people be so re-traumatizing. So having someone that just knew your whole history, mm-hmm. I think is such a support.
For sure, definitely. And I mean, every time I'd meet a new midwife, they would go through my notes and I could see the point where they'd read about postpartum psychosis. Because they would go from, oh, your first child, yes, you had a cesarean emergency. Oh. So I was like, oh, goodness. I was like, how many times am I have to go through this? So I felt very relieved that it was Dr. Taha. I was like, okay, great.
Of course. I wanted to end by asking you on what your work in that space was, because I know you are active, aren't you, in the kind of campaigning around our understanding of postpartum psychosis. What does it involve, your role there?
Yes. Yeah, so I first was, there's an organization called Action on Postpartum Psychosis, which is based in the UK, but it also does a lot of work in the US. And it's about raising awareness, and also it has an incredible team of volunteers who will give support to women and families who are going through postpartum psychosis. And, you know, a lot of these volunteers are people with lived experience, so they're incredibly passionate about it. I came across them when I was, you know, trying to recover, and I found their forum. And when they found out I had written a book about it, they asked me to be an ambassador, which just meant like sharing my story, which seemed so simple at the time. But then you realize, I've heard from so many women since that they have trouble talking about it. And I think that to me just feels like that means, you know, we just have to allow people the space to talk about it without feeling any sense of shame. And so I think that's very powerful. Mm-hmm. And then last year I joined as a trustee. And I think it's just, I mean, I'm still learning. I really would say I don't really feel like I contribute too much. But it's mostly, I think, just about trying to figure out how to better support women. And I think what's really devastating, and, you know, I'm reminded of this anytime we have a meeting, is, you know, hearing from the partners of women who do die, you know, they take their lives, or who are not, or who are still struggling. But I think it's a temporary illness. And I think that's the thing that I find most difficult, is for the people who don't make it through. That I find very difficult.
It is incredibly difficult. I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking of the news stories where women have been condemned for going through that. And it is an illness. It is an illness, and it is a temporary illness if people get the right support. I can't thank you enough for how eloquent you've been. So thank you so much, Catherine.
Oh, thank you, Pandora. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Doing It Right. Don't forget, the whole of Series 4 is available to binge now. If you liked the show, please do give it a rating or a review on iTunes. And if you want to chat more about any of the episodes, you can email me at doingitrightpod@gmail.com. Doing It Right is presented by me, Pandora Sykes, with sound by Kelsey Bennett, and production by Pandora Sykes and Kelsey Bennett.